This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Friday today. I actually forgot. I'm going to turn on the air conditioning here because I have air conditioning because I have charged the air conditioner. So I'll have air conditioning for, I don't know, about 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm going to have to charge it up again. It's Friday because yesterday we had some friends coming in, and they're staying with us for a couple of days, and I was rushing around apparently in the morning to get into work so that I could leave work so that I could meet them when they got to our house, and I completely forgot to take the recorder with me. Or, as I'm fond of saying, I chose not to remember. So I didn't actually take the recorder and put it where I would see it. And I didn't realize that. I think until I was leaving, I was like, But that's okay. So I actually went in this morning, as I normally do on Fridays, to pick up my dad and take him grocery shopping. And so we've got that done. I'm leaving his house now, which is a little shorter drive than normal, but I'll just keep gabbing until I'm done. It's been a good week. We had a vendor come in this week to talk about a business process management system. And that was interesting. The next step is they're going to find some customers for us to go to talk to their customers, and then they're going to set me up a virtual segment to where I can hop in and just sort of flounder around and see if I can get done anything of substance. So it's very interesting. It's all just very, very interesting. So we're in the process of going through all that and kind of checking some things out and trying to make some decisions. The book is puttering along. With our friends coming in this weekend, I didn't really expect to hit 10,000 words this week, and lo and behold, that's coming true. So I think right now I'm down about 900 words, 900, maybe 1,000 words for where I'm supposed to be at this point in the week, which normally wouldn't be that big of a deal. I've been known to accelerate and crank that out. But with our friends here, I'm not really sure what the rest of the day is going to hold. And then there's a graduation. One of our friends is graduating tomorrow. That's why she's in town. And so we're going to her graduation. And then I think we're going out to lunch afterwards, so, you know, where I normally have a block of, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 hours on a Saturday that can be available to me, I think this Saturday, that's going to get cut down significantly, so that's okay. I mean, the goal is to have 80,000 words by June 1st. Because that would put me over halfway with this next book, Windfall, Wheat and Tares. But, you know, actually, if I get to 75,000, that will put me over halfway as well. And it's puttering along pretty good. There's still a whole bunch. I have no idea what's going to happen in this book. But it's just so interesting. You just keep wandering forward and then the clouds part and something happens and you go, oh, hey. The voice is actually a little rough today. I'm apparently trying to come down with a cold, arg. And I don't know for sure where I got it. The only thing I can think is I got it from a technician who had replaced the keyboard on my laptop. I don't know if I mentioned this, but I bought a new laptop, pretty Dell XPS 15, 9550, but I was having trouble with it, that every time, you know, not every time, but I was getting double spaces on the space bar, or double M's and double C's, and just, you know, wasn't good. I've never had a keyboard act like that. So I called up Dell, and they, you know, we went through the whole thing, and they finally said, okay, we need to replace that keyboard. So they sent out a technician to me because I paid the extra for the on-site service. He came to me, replaced the keyboard. It's good. Now it feels like a real keyboard, and it actually works. So yay, that took care of that. I was considering just living with it, but when you spend that much money for a laptop, it's really nice if it works, and it's working. So moving through the book, I think I just started chapter 10, which, you know, if I make it to about chapter 15 or so, there's usually about 30 chapters-ish in these books. So make it about chapter 15, chapter 16 before I quit to do the production version for the fourth book. You know, I think it'll be fine. And the feedback is coming in from the fourth book. And so that's all going fine. And we're fine. Everything's puttering along. So anyways, this week I was listening to a TED Talk, and I had heard about this before, but I really didn't know what the resolution was. And in fact, there has been no resolution. But there were several key elements about this story that I thought were just really fun. And we'll just wait and see how this all works out. And it may in fact be that it never works out. It's just a mystery. And it'll be really interesting to see if we find more of these situations out there in the universe. So, Kepler, I mentioned the Kepler telescope a number of times. Kepler, when they put it up, they had Kepler focus on one area of space, one little rectangle of space, and they just had it sit there for 4 years and record and record and record and record. And then what they did with the data is they turned loose their algorithms on it, and the idea was to look for drops in light level, periodic drops in light level. And they had, the Kepler instrument is very sophisticated, very sensitive, and they had written some, you know, sensitive, sophisticated algorithms to go through and look for this periodicity of this drop in luminosity, and based on that, then with calculations, they can figure out how far the planet that's orbiting that particular star is from its star. You know, is it in the habitable zone? Make a guess as to what its composition might be, etc., etc., etc. Well, what's interesting is the lady who was talking, who was, I think, on this team that was doing all of this, she said there was this idea that came up that what if the computers missed something? A couple of weeks ago, we talked about a problem in quantum physics that was extremely difficult and laborious for computers to calculate, and that the group that was trying to do that decided, why don't we use humans? And we talked about the fact that humans have this capacity to make these intuitive leaps and get to solutions where it doesn't seem like there's any path that gets them to that solution. You know, it's just like tink. And I had talked about the fact that I personally feel that's just God whispering in the world. He's helping us out. So, you know, the astronomers at Yale were wondering, well, what if computers missed something? So they launched this citizen project that they called Planet Hunters, to have people look at exactly the same data that Kepler was looking at. And what's interesting is that there was a lot of skepticism at the time. The presenter said that my colleague Deborah Fitcher, the founder of that said that at the time people were saying, you know, you're crazy. There's no way that a computer will miss a signal. But she said, you know, it was on. The classic human versus machine gamble. And they said if they had found one planet, they would be thrilled. She said when she joined the team 4 years ago, we had already found a couple. And she said today, with the help of over 300,000 scientists, science enthusiasts, we have found dozens. And she said, we've also found one of the most mysterious stars in the galaxy, which is really, this is really interesting. She gave as an example that Jupiter, when it transits across Sol, our star, she said it will make about a 1% drop in the star's brightness. She said, Earth, on the other hand, which is 11 times smaller than Jupiter, when it transits, she said the signal is barely visible in the data. She said, well, some of these citizen scientists were sifting through data, and they spotted this signal that was coming from a star designated KIC 8462852. She said the observations in May of 2009 were the first they spotted, and they started talking about this in the discussion forums. And she said, what made this special is that the transits usually last a few hours, and this transit lasted for almost a week. And in addition to that, it looked asymmetrical. She said, normally a transit, you get this very gentle curve down and up, kind of like a sine wave, whoosh, whoosh, you know, as Jupiter goes across. This one, there was a gradual decline on one side, and then it sort of vaulted back up. And so it took longer to get dim than it took to brighten, which is a little odd, but she said, what's interesting about that is that seemed to indicate that whatever was blocking the starlight was not circular like a planet. She said, there are a few more times, more dips that happened, but for a couple of years, it was quiet. She said, then in March of 2011, and she put up the thing, she said, we see this. She said, the star's light dropped 15%. 15%. And this was also asymmetric. She said, having a dimming that lasts almost a week, and then it snaps back to normal within just a couple of days. And then, she said, after that, not much happens until February of 2013. Then, she said, things got crazy. And she showed the graph. There's all these dips, minor dips, major dips that are happening, and they last for like 100 days all the way up to the end of Kepler's mission. They have various shapes. Some are sharp, some are broad, some last just a day or two, some last for more than a week. There's uptrends and downtrends within some of these dips, almost like several independent events were superimposed on top of each other. And she said, and this time, the star drops in its brightness over 20%. And she said, that means whatever is blocking its light has an area of over 1,000 times the area of planet Earth. And she said, when the citizen scientists saw all this, they notified the science team that they had found something weird enough that it might be worth following up. So when the science team looked at it, they're like, yeah, there's probably just something wrong with the data. But she said, we looked really, really hard, and the data was good. So it had to be happening in the astrophysical realm, which means it was actually happening in space. So she said, at this time, we set out to learn everything we could about this star. and try to find any clues as to what was going on. And the citizen scientist, you know, came along for the ride. And she said a lot of people had a lot of theories. Maybe a, you know, a planet collision, or maybe there's a bunch of comets, you know. And she said, you could resolve it that way. She said, but in order for it to be comets, she said it would take hundreds of comets to reproduce. And these are only the comets that happen to pass between us and the star. And because you're looking at this star along a plane, and so anything that goes over the star or around the star on the other side, you're not going to see that. She said, so we're really talking about tens of thousands of comets. But she said that of the best of all the bad ideas that we had, she said that was the best. So she said, we went ahead and published our findings. Now, what's funny about this is they actually gave their paper a title of Where's the Flux, which, you know, if you take the acronym from the title, they were actually, the acronym is, you know, WTF, which of course stands for something else, because the scientists were just, they just didn't know what to think about this. So she said, this isn't the end of the story. She said, about the same time I was writing this paper, she said, I met with a colleague of mine, Jason Wright. He was also writing a paper on the Kepler data. Just a second. I'm backing into my garage. And he was going through, and the premise of his paper was, in all of the Kepler data, we have not found any evidence of alien life. And she said, so I showed him this stuff. And she said that he thought that with the Kepler's extreme precision, it could actually detect alien megastructures around stars, but it didn't, she said. And then I showed him this weird data that our citizen scientists had found, and he said to me, "Ah, crap, Tabby, now I have to rewrite my paper." So, you know, they're trying to get more stuff. They're looking, they're trying to, and they're saying, okay, well, you know, but if it's an alien megastructure, it would put off heat. We're not seeing this. I mean, they're trying to figure out what in the world's going on. And honestly, I just love this. I just love stuff that is mysterious and that gives us something else to think about and gives us something else to investigate. And, you know, am I concerned that this might actually show that there's life on another planet and we might be alone? No, I am not. I don't have any problem at all with life existing on another planet. I don't have any problem at all with God sticking his finger down in the soup somewhere else and getting things started. You know, because God can do what he wants to do. And why do we need so much to be the only ones? Just seems a bit narcissistic to me, which is in context with the rest of our existence, because frankly, there's a whole lot of narcissism in our world. Me, 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 me. The scientist said that, you know, she said, as a scientist, my money is on the natural explanation. She said, but don't get me wrong. I think it would be awesome to find aliens. She said, either way, there is something new and really interesting to discover. And see, that's cool. That's, I just love that, that humans do have this sense of curiosity that drives us to figure stuff out and look beyond and question. And I love that the universe is this playground where we can figure things out. And we can, there's, it seems like there's always something else to discover. She said, unfortunately, Kepler is off to a different mission at this point. But I guess because the dips are so huge, You know, we don't really need Kepler. She said, we've got all these other citizen scientists now that are coming to save the day because all these backyard astronomers are swinging their telescopes around now to study this star and make measurements because the dips are big enough that they can do that. But this is what she said that I think is amazing, too. She said, what's amazing to me is that this star would have never been found by computers because we just weren't looking for something like this. And she said, and there's more data coming, and the citizen scientists are going to be studying it, and there's new missions that are coming up and observing millions of more stars all over the sky. And so there's just so much more to do and so much more to learn. And that is just cool. She did say at the end, and just think, what will it mean when we find another star like this? And what will it mean if we don't find another star like this? And at some point in the talk, she was saying it just would be so cool if, in fact, we had witnessed some kind of interplanetary battle where whole fleets were being wiped out. And that's why there's these. Now, it's not going to be great for the people whose fleets are getting wiped out, but that we actually have borne witness to some instance of alien life doing something. This is a wonderful world. It's a wonderful life. And there's all kinds of things to find if we'll just look around for them. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.